Donalana Kitchen Talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Beautiful weather outside. The trees are just starting to turn. It's the autumnal equinox. That's a balance between light and dark. Today's show is a balance of this and that. Some leftover topics from past shows. Apples and pears. Chickens and eggs. Lana's latest adventure in the kitchen with a jelly roll. Donna will talk about her weekend field trip to the Story City Locker, and we'll have some tasty bits of news and gossip. So, happy autumnal equinox. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And Donna's got a few things to say about the equinox.
Well, the equinox is just like it says, equal days and equal nights. And in the pagan pre-Christian tradition, it was the day when Persephone comes up from the underground as the queen, and she's no longer the maiden, and Venus, or her mother, goes into the underground to build the roots, and she comes up to make the branches, which makes the tree of life. And it's also kind of the beginning from now through Halloween, or is it Lammas?
Samhain?
Yeah, there's a...
Oh, goodness. My Gaelic is not very good.
Samhain. But it begins the season when they say the veil is the thinnest between the worlds, which is why, like Halloween, we have skeletons and witches and kind of otherworldly personas or creations visiting us here in this world. Cemeteries, gravestones, you know, that sort of thing. So we're moving into the darkest part of the season. It'll get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until we reach the solstice, the winter solstice.
Right, right. Makes a whole lot of sense when you're actually really connected to where your food comes from, because the garden goes away this time of year. It's just starting. The pumpkins are turned. There's lots of squash and fall things at the farmer's market.
We're late, though, again. I've seen pumpkins. But I haven't seen my favorite kabocha squash yet.
Describe a kabocha squash.
The kabocha squash is green, shaped like a smaller pumpkin. It's my favorite because it has the most intensely rich orange flavor, even more than a butternut, more than an acorn, I think more than a pumpkin. When they come, we're going to have a kabocha squash show.
Oh, good, good.
Absolutely.
Love squash. No, just wait. I planted various pumpkins this year, and so I'll not that I remember exactly what they are, but all the different sorts of different shapes are coming up out there.
For decorative, or are you going to cook with them?
Well, one of them I know because I actually found the little marker. It's called a long pie pumpkin, and that one is
for making long pies.
No, the shape of the pumpkin is actually long. It looks like a banana.
Like a butternut,
but without the bulb at the end.
How interesting.
It looks like a large orange pickle is what it looks like.
Oh, like a delicata squash shape, only orange.
Only orange. Oh, it's called a long pie pumpkin. I believe I got them from Fedco Seeds. It just looked good. Also, it said in the catalog that it was not an overly large pumpkin, which tends to be a bit imposing. These are smaller.
Oh, Lana, I can see a pumpkin tasting in our future.
Oh, pumpkin tasting. Well, see, we are moving into fall. It's the equinox. Happy equinox, everybody.
It was actually exact last night, very close to 9:30.
Oh, good report there. Good report. We have some news items on the Donalana Kitchen. Not that we're a news organization, so we shall call this news and gossip items. All right.
As far as I'm concerned, they're the same thing.
The same thing. Same thing. This, is, after all, is a kitchen table.
Yeah, and I personally think that gossip has been defined as the way women talk to each other, and the negative connotations of gossip probably come as some other form of female denigration. Oh. So, you know, I think gossip is healthy. You know, we're not going to speak badly of people, but sometimes it's really good to know what everyone's doing. It's storytelling.
Good. So, this week, on the news.
Oh, on the news. Okay, we have a couple of things. There was, of course, the climate change march in New York City. And then yesterday, I think there was a promising note when the Rockefeller Family Foundation announced that they were going to join the divestiture group. So they are saying they're selling all of their oil stocks. The quote was something like that they felt that Grandpa John D. Rockefeller, which used to be Standard Oil, would have approved of the divestiture based on the fact that it's important to save the planet, that he had values along those lines. And also, people are also saying that if oil is in fact being that destructive, it may not be a good business investment. So there you have it, straight from the Rockefellers.
So things can change. You wouldn't have thought a couple of years ago. Remember back so many years ago and when everyone was divesting from South Africa? That worked, too. Take the money out of something and people's minds change.
Yeah, a lot bigger, and it is global. And supposedly at this point, not so much colleges and universities, but the people like the Rockefellers have promised to divest almost $50 billion.
Oh, that seems a chunk of change.
Yeah, it's hard to know because the math gets pretty fuzzy with those big numbers, but, you know,
right.
It's a little bit of good news.
Maybe that's small change to those on the top of the pile, but at least it seems things are moving in the right direction.
Okay, now going in the other direction.
Oh, more news, more gossip.
There was a story I read about that the USDA, that is the United States Department of Agriculture, has requested heavy armaments like machine guns and things like that. In order to protect our food system. So it's been a bit controversial. There are some lawsuits against it. They're saying basically, you know, if the USDA has to deal with like some pirates or something where they might need that sort of thing, really they should do like normal people do and call in the sheriff, you know.
Oh, dear.
I know. Instead of having to arm everybody with machine guns, it's a bit ominous because what they've been doing with those is occasionally things like raiding farmers for selling raw milk, possibly using all these armaments for just sheer intimidation. It could be dangerous out there in the farmlands with the USDA running rampant, armed with submachine guns. And
well, also, we have the USDA. That's their job. They're supposed to look into our food system. Last week, we talked about making jelly, and the USDA kind of has its fingers in that pot, too, to make sure our canned goods and jelly and things are good for sale. So watch out. I really don't think that we need to have the USDA with machine guns
at the farmer's market
protecting us against terrorist jelly. That sounds a bit extreme. Talk to the people that are in charge, folks.
Right. Let's say the USDA could call in the army or something if they really need them, or the Coast Guard if they're dealing with pirates or somebody that knows how to use those weapons properly.
The issue of raw milk is a big deal, especially in dairy states. That is the non-pasteurized milk, selling milk directly from the cow. That doesn't mean it's dirty. It means it hasn't been pasteurized. Like anything else, people have reasons for drinking raw milk.
It has a full enzyme component.
Yeah. Right. The fact that we live in interesting times. Things are changing. The fact that such a issue would raise a threat. So stay tuned, folks.
We'll at some point have a milk show, maybe in the winter when we run out of vegetables.
Sounds good. Oh, there's been so much wonderful things for cows to eat this summer. Milk has been wonderful. Good. Another news item. This is Banned Books Week. Censorship.
I didn't know we still ban books.
Oh, we do. Censorship affects the intellectual, cultural, and political life of the community and the people in it. Books are banned all the time by local school boards, concerned citizens in small towns. It doesn't mean that the books are banned forever. It just means that a certain bunch of people can intimidate a librarian, a teacher, a bookstore owner, and not allow them to put it in the window or not allow the children to read it. So it's a testy sort of thing. Since 1982, there have been over 1,300 books in schools, libraries, and bookstores that have been challenged. That doesn't mean that nobody can read them. That just means that they have been pulled off the shelf because it was just easier to not make these citizens mad.
This might be a good week to go to our brand new library and ask them about banned books. I don't know if we ban books here. I don't know. We've got a pretty good library. One would hope not.
Well, if enough people complain, and it's not that books are burned, it's that they are put on the naughty list. And the idea that books...
What, do we have a back room in the library where you can keep all the naughty books?
Yeah.
What's naughty? Oh, you were saying, you were using examples. What were some of the examples of banned books?
This year. Actually, if you want to celebrate Banned Books Week, you might want to go out and pick up a copy of some of these books. Captain Underpants is on the list, and that's a great children's book. I mean, the word underpants must be really inflammatory. It must be almost as bad as raw milk. Captain Underpants, the book, is on the list. Another book is The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. And I found this interesting. Ooh. The original book version of The Hunger Games also upsets some people. And the idea
that... let's take it out of the library, but be sure to see it at the movie theater.
Be sure to see it at the movie theater. And remember, just because a book or an idea upsets someone does not mean it should be off limits. We can't live in a culture where it's better to hide from controversial topics.
Let's not provoke anybody to think, for goodness sake.
All this stuff is to think with. So it's Banned Books
Week. Banned Book Week.
Go out and read Huckleberry Finn. That also gets people's panties in a twist, as they say.
Yes, and do go to our library anyway and ask them if we have any banned books and also thank them for just being there for us.
Yes. We have to... share what we know and keep reading. Keep sharing ideas. Another news item. Another gossip item.
This is a good one.
Very good one. Local gossip, local news. There is a new chef in town. The restaurant that used to be called for many, many years. Formerly known as Lucalans is under new management. And the new managers of Lucalans, used to be Lucalans, but now it's called something else, hired a brand new chef. They are starting up. They remodeled. So go and push your nose against the window and look what they've done at the Lucalans building. They have remodeled.
So that's right on Main Street in downtown Ames.
Yep. And the new chef's name is Brett DeBleek.
And the new restaurant name is?
Bar La Tosca.
Toop-de-doo.
Right. Chef Brett says that although Lucalans used to be sort of a Italian sort of theme, he is talking it more about it as a Mediterranean theme. So it's much broader than
however,
just pasta.
However, he's using a lot of local produce. So
a lot
I would
of
say
local
it's
produce.
A nice Midwestern-themed restaurant.
I think so, too. I was one of the lucky people that was invited to a pre-opening sort of test out the wait staff and make sure the kitchen is running sort of evening. And they have just wonderful things. And so go and check that out. I hear that they are having, not only really, really fine things to eat with pastas, entrees. They have small plates.
Cocktail bar.
Yes. And wonderful desserts. I hear, gossip, that it will not just be an evening menu, but they're looking into a sandwich menu. They're looking into a brunch menu, and possibly even a late night sort of menu. So stop into Bar La Tosca.
Now, we're not sure when they're opening. It's kind of vague. Maybe sometime this week. Maybe by the weekend. So just go tap on the door.
Tap on the door and ask.
Trying.
They're nice people. Good bit of news.
More good food and names. Yay.
Yes. And I happen to know that I met this Chef DeBleek, and he's quite the character. I think he's way too young to have all this experience, but he told me that he's been working in or has started up 8 new restaurants in the past 11 years. He's been around, folks.
Yeah, he's from the Minneapolis area, but I know he's cooked in Japan, Mexico, the West Coast. I can't remember if it's Seattle or Portland, but he has an educated palate, but he's a good Midwestern fellow.
He's been around. Go eat some good food, and it's local, too. It's local. Okay, another thing. Donna went to a field, while I was chowing down all of, at the Bar La Tosca, Donna went to a PFI field day at the Story City Locker and learned about, well, at the, I believe the title of the event was called Make and Bake, and it was about how meat happens. So tell us about that, Donna.
Well, that was Practical Farmers of Iowa, and it was on Sunday up in Story City. I have to say I visited all the antique stores while I was up there. Wowzer. It was an overwhelming array. But at the field day, we did have a tour of the locker, which Lana and I had already done, and we've had Bobby from Story City Locker on the radio. If you missed that, go on our archives and check out that interview with her. It was quite fun. But also, Kathy and Herb Eckhouse from La Quercia showed up. Now, we haven't really talked too much about La Quercia, and it's one of the pride of Iowa food companies that we have here. They do cured meats, and their business is in Norwalk, which is just south of Des Moines. They are certainly nationally renowned. They are considered the best domestic prosciutto and cured meats provider. They, I would say that, you know, their products are certainly as good, if not better, than many of the imported products that you buy. They lived in Parma, which is the home of Parma hams and Parmesan cheese for
across the pond.
Yes, in Italy, for about 3 years, and they just fell in love with the meats that they have there. And being good Iowans, when they return back home, they're going, you know, but we're major pork producers here. Why aren't we having products like that with our good Iowa pork? So they went through all the hurdles that the USDA requires, and then some, to build a plant to cure hams. Now, the thing is, you have to, and they use, Nyman Ranch meats and other multiple, I don't know, they have an organic line, but it's all humanely raised, no antibiotics and no hormones. Of course, pigs don't get hormones usually anyway. But what their business is once you get the meat, you know, you hang up the hams and you let it hang, some of it for as long as 2 years. You know, there are various things that, you know, they salt it, they put herbs and spices, and they let it hang, and they let it hang, and they let it hang, and then we derive the most succulent things from this. But they also, besides prosciutto, they also do lardo, lonza, lomo, coppa, spellaccia, guanciale, pancetta, and bacon. Now, these are from different cuts of the pig. So it's not just the leg they're using. Like, guanciale is the jowl. And some of these things are, actually, you can get them in Ames, certainly at Wheatsfield, probably at some of the other local stores. They sell the prosciutto packaged and sliced. They also sell the salumis around quite a bit. You can order online. We had a tasting. Yum, 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 yum. They also do some real specialty things where they use specific breeds of pork, like Tamworth smoked pancetta. They have some acorn-fed lines. Part of what we were talking about at the field day is pigs, more so even than cattle, what they eat, like if they eat acorns or if they eat corn or if they eat grains or if they're pasture-fed, drastically affects the flavor. I mean, well, subtly, anyway. So we taste, I mean, much more so than, say, beef or maybe even chicken. But, and that's the fun of it. If you finish your pigs on apples, for example, you get a different flavor than if you're just giving them corn or something like that. So we had some really good products. Watch for that brand around when you see it. It's La Quercia, L-A-Q-U-E-R-C-I-A, and it kind of, that's an oak tree, and so it has the little oak tree logo on it.
Does La Quercia in Italian mean oaks?
I think it does.
Or tree or something. Anyway.
I think it's oaks. But it is all American made and American inspired cured meats. Kathy and Herb Eckhouse from Norwalk, Iowa. It's an Iowa proud product.
Good. So that was the PFI Field Day, making bacon, pork processing, curing, and tasting.
Oh, Practical Farmers of Iowa.
You had a good time. It's always good to know where your pork comes from. And just like us, you are what you eat. So we'll take a little break here. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about local pork here on KHOI Radio, community radio station. Support this station. Listen to this station. Donate to this station. Enjoy and tell your friends about this station.
Enjoy this station.
Yes.
I do.
You can find past Donna Lana Kitchen shows on the KHOIFM.org website. Everything's archived. Everything is being streamed now, so connect up with us any way you can. You can find past Donna Lana Kitchen shows, past recipes, and all kinds of stuff on that website.
Yes, in case you're so modern that you no longer have a radio, you can use your computer.
You find us lots of different ways. We've been talking about the Story City Locker Field Day that featured meat and products from La Quercia. And I have this note that says, ask Donna about white product in tubes. Now, this sound, I thought this sounded like toothpaste, but I'm sure it isn't toothpaste. What exactly is white product in tubes?
Well, La Quercia had a product, and I say had because it's not on the market right now, but they called it Iowa White. And what it was, as they trim the prosciutto, which has this lovely cured seasoned fat, they trimmed it for packaging. They had the fat, some fats left over, and they ground it up and packaged it as Iowa White. So it was a great product to use as kind of a finishing oil. For example, if you're making polenta, while the polenta is still warm, you just, at the end of the cooking, you would stir in some Iowa White. It would give it a wonderful, instead of butter, for example, you would get the flavor of the prosciutto kind of subtly infused into the polenta, and there were many other uses. But Herb Eckhouse told me that he had stopped making it. And I went, oh, no, Herb, don't do that. Because, you know, it's a product that you can't really make at home. I mean, you could, but the contortions that one would have to go through would make it really rare, and Herb has plenty of it. So he told me he was using that product in a, was it an andouille or something he's working on? He's always tinkering and playing about with these wonderful
that's
products.
That's a sausage product.
Yes.
It's a flavoring. It's like,
absolutely.
It's like putting butter or olive oil, but this has got, seasoned, smoked, cured pork flavor.
It's actually not smoked. It's not aged.
Aged, uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it is in tubes because that's how they're packaging it.
He told me that, by popular demand, he's going to start doing again. But it used to be in tubs, but he thinks he's going to put it in tubes, which I think is a good idea. Then you just squirt a little on.
You don't need that much.
Into your pasta, yeah, or something like that. This conversation was all happening weekend before last at the Nyman Ranch dinner. And I'll tell you what one chef did there. He made lardo whipped cream.
Lardo.
So it's basically whipped cream that tastes like pork. It was about 50% whipped cream, but what he did before that is he took some of the La Quercia the product that's cut from the prosciutto. He rendered it down to get it kind of liquid, oily enough to incorporate into the whipped cream, and then it was very lightly seasoned. Now, this was served with something like a fried donut hole or a beignet. It's a round donut hole size thing that had small chunks of bacon in it. So he had these little battered donut-like things with bits of bacon, and then you dipped it into the whipped cream lardo, which was absolutely and slightly sweetened. So this is it was a delicious treat. Sounds so that's like, Iowa White, as the Eckhouses call it. And
so look for that in the future. I mean, I'm anxious to try this sort of thing. I can think of lots of things.
Believe
I can
me,
put
when I find a tube of that and it's actually produced, I will be trumpeting it on the radio.
Oh, all right. We will let you know. Another seasonal thing that we're going to talk about today are pears and apples. What did you find out about pears and apples, Donna?
Well, the one thing about pears, they're like the most delicate, mysterious, non-tropical fruit. And there's an old saying, a pear is only perfect for about 10 minutes, you know, because you really have to watch them if they're underripe. And some pears are more so, like a Comice pear has a moment when it's almost like ice cream. If it's too green, it's still chewy. Once it's past its point, it starts getting really sloppy. Anjou pears are also that way. Bosque is, even though it's still, Bosque is a firmer pear, so it's a little more tolerant.
Bosque, B-O-S-C, Bosque?
I think that's how, I'm not a good speller, Lana.
Oh.
But they're the harder
pears. It's a crossword puzzle word. I think that's
it. Yeah, it's a harder pear that is very good for poaching, for example. Like, you know, there are cooking apples and eating apples. There are cooking pears and eating pears. What are those little tiny pears called? I can't.
Seckle.
Seckle pears.
Seckle.
Oh, love the seckle pears. Have you seen any this year?
You were talking to me about gleaning. There used to be a tree in Campus Town.
A seckle pear tree?
A seckle pear tree. And it was always complained about because it was falling into a parking lot kind of behind the Campus Town fire station. It was kind of back in there among the garbage cans.
Wow.
And for 2 or 3 years, I went back there and gleaned, which means I helped myself too. I'm sure they were seckle pears because you ate them and the juice would run down your arm. They were so
lovely. Little.
And
right?
They were little, lots of little things. So that's a seckle pear. There are some around. I haven't seen a seckle pear tree around in a long time. So we're talking about gleaning, which means going out and making use of what's there.
Well, for example, as I was driving down Lincoln Highway out towards where the overpass is for I-35, on the south side of the street, there is a huge, gorgeous apple tree. And you can see, even as you're driving by rather quickly, you'll see that it is loaded with apples that are just turning slightly pinkish. And I kept, and nobody's picking it. It's by some, I don't know, tech company or something. So I stopped, and I thought, I have to taste these at least and see, you know, what's just, and the ground is covered with unpicked apples and stuff like that. So I did pick some, and it's a very, very sweet apple. You know, obviously, if you're picking from a tree that's on private property, it's a good idea to ask, but Do watch. There are a lot of people around that have apple trees they consider decorative, or they're just, I mean, that tree looks like it had been, maybe there was a farm there years ago, and then a more modern building had been built, and the tree itself is beautiful. But no one's picking those apples. So gleaning is a good idea, as long as it's not taking from somebody who's trying to grow those apples for their own use.
Ask around.
It's the waste not want not principle.
Also, it's part of this new thing called urban agriculture. There's no reason we can't coexist and live with things that are growing just because we haven't planted them. It's part of the commons.
Right. In my yard, I've planted a persimmon tree, which is now grown to about 10 feet. So, you know, hopefully some year it will make persimmon. Of course, I have a cherry tree, an apple tree. And I have a tiny, very city lot.
And as those things reach out of your lot and fall on somebody else's somebody else's light or as people go by. It's the sort of thing we should share. We're gathering from the earth, not necessarily, it's not so much a commodity as a gift, as a gift.
And we can share them with the bees that come around and the birds that eat the ones on the ground. There is plenty, you know.
There is plenty.
We are in apple plenty and pear plenty right now.
What did you make with your apples?
Oh, I had a request from my neighbor. We were doing a little get-together, and we had a kind of 50s-themed cocktail party. They said, oh, Donna, make a Waldorf salad. So inspired by your leek and apple salad, I kind of went, I can remember, you know, sometimes Waldorf salads are made with whipped cream. Or maybe I was thinking even of the Jell-O and whipped cream salads. Mm-hmm. Weren't they called perfection salads or something like that? So first I thought, oh, I think I'll make it with whipped cream rather than mayonnaise. And then I decided I would make it with cream fraiche. So I made my own cream fraiche by taking heavy whipping cream and culturing it with my my kefir culture, just leaving it overnight. And I think you could also do quite well with just sour cream in this.
Tell me about cream fraiche. It seems like a most exotic thing that you have to go out and buy at some sort of store. It's a just slightly sour, not quite sour cream. It's
heavy
very
cream.
It's heavy cream, but it's just lightly tinged a little bit. The cream fraiche or creme fraiche, it's a wonderful thing to add,
well,
especially to fruit.
What they use mostly in Europe is, in France, I would say, instead of sour cream, like we would call it sour cream, and it probably sour cream started from the same thing, cream that you had cultured. There is a slightly different flavor, and I think some of that is because creme fraiche is higher in fat than some of our sour creams, but they're close.
So you started with some heavy cream.
Yeah, I just took heavy whipping cream, basically.
Whipping cream.
And put the culture in it overnight, and then I ended up with creme fraiche. So I mixed that with fresh lemon juice, sugar, a little bit of cardamom, not too much. I didn't want it to dominate, and a little bit of coriander, a little salt and pepper, and then I cut up three kinds of apples. So the gleaned apples, which were very sweet, and then I used, that was the dominant apple. Then I used, I used six of the sweet apples, two Granny Smiths to give it a little tartar, and then I used a pink pearl apple. I know they have them at Wheatsfield. The pink pearl was not so much for flavor. I find the flavor's okay. But the nice thing about them is they are pink on the inside, so it puts some color in it. It was really pretty. And then I used, of course, celery, grapes. I toasted my walnuts. I used large green grapes. And I ran this all through the slicing blade on the food processor. So I just quartered the apples and dropped them in the chute and ran them through. Even the grapes I ran through, the celery I ran through. So it was actually very quick. So it was the grapes, the celery, the apples, the lemon juice, the cream fraiche, and kind of you just do it to taste, and sugar, and then toasted the walnuts, and put them in at the end. And it was marvelous.
That's a Waldorf salad.
Yeah.
Does the Waldorf salad come from the Hotel Waldorf?
I think it might, actually.
It sounds very elegant. It sounds like the sort of thing that would have been invented beginning of the last century. Who knows?
Well, it's quite delicious anyway. Yeah. Very seasonally appropriate right now.
Right. It is apple season. It's also time for apple cider, and there'll be cider pressings around. Different apple orchards are doing special events. Some apple orchards are even getting into making hard cider, so check those things out. And next week we'll have a local person come on and talk about cider pressing at her farm. Oh, Donna, you also had going to report a little bit on your shrub and the fact that it's something that takes a while, but I tasted it, and I would have never even guessed what it was. So
well,
back up and tell us.
We've kind of been talking about shrubs over multiple shows, and the shrub, to remind you, is it's a fruit or herb infusion with sugar, and then you add vinegar. And it does have to be refrigerated, but it does keep the fruit or the herb it's a preservation technique. And it shrubs were the sort of thing that people drank, use it as a flavoring with water or alcohol. And this was what people had before we had sodas and things like that. So my progress is that I have made, a couple weeks ago, I took lemon verbena and a little peach and sugar and mashed them together, lemon verbena dominant. I also had made a raspberry. Oh, boy, what did I put in that one? Well, it was mostly raspberry shrub. And of course, they're sitting in the refrigerator, and you're supposed to let them age at least 30 days. And what's happening is the fruit flavor is coming forward, or the lemon verbena flavor, and they're becoming less vinegary on the tongue. And they're getting quite good. I like this shrub concept. We may be, this may be a winner.
Right. What a nice experiment to do in your refrigerator, the shrub. We also have a leftover topic. Kitchens often have leftovers. We have a leftover topic from last week that we didn't get into.
And last week was our jelly making, jams and jellies.
We talked about jams and jellies. And I remember from my childhood, my mom and grandmother often made jelly roll, a good use for jelly. So I kind of snarfled around in my kitchen and found some old recipes. I think I unearthed my grandmother's recipe. I haven't found my mom's recipe. I made a jelly roll. That was my adventure in
sitting right here in front
Here's
of us,
a jelly
and
roll.
It is beautiful.
A jelly roll is very simple. It's a sponge cake wrapped around a jar of jelly. Not the jar. You take it out of the jar. But it ends up being a roll, and it's very easy to serve. It's very quick to make, except the trick of the whole jelly roll is getting that flat, large pound cake or sponge cake rolled up. That's tricky.
Okay, so tell us how you do this. Because I think when my grandson comes for a visit at the end of the month, I think I want to make a jelly roll cake. I think it'd be fun for children.
Oh, I think it is too. It's this one is quite sweet. It doesn't have to be so sweet. It lasts for a while. It goes good at a potluck. And especially in the winter or any time when you've got some jelly that you know you're not going to get around to eating, or something that you want to put in a jelly roll. You can also put a lemon curd or something else.
Or gooseberry curd,
or
like we had.
Curds, yes.
Jams, jellies, that means you could flavor it. And I bet you could flavor the cakes, too. Like, couldn't you make a sort of pumpkin flavored with apple butter for Halloween or something like that?
The brain reels with possibilities. It's
absolutely
a cake wrapped up around jelly.
Okay, so tell me how you do the roll part, because I want to try this.
Okay. Now, this jelly roll is just the simple sponge cake, and I used rhubarb jam in this.
So do I get to taste this right now?
You and our in-studio engineer also has to do this. So
pardon my fingers. Oh boy.
This jelly roll recipe goes: 3 eggs separated, 1 cup sugar, 1 tablespoon lemon rind, 2 tablespoons lemon juice, cup sifted cake flour, quarter teaspoon salt, confectioner's sugar to dust, and a cup of jam or jelly. You beat the egg whites in one bowl until stiff, and add half the sugar to that. Beat the egg yolks until lemon-colored and thick, and add the rest of the remaining sugar to that. And then continue to beat that for a while. Add the lemon juice and lemon rind, and fold in the egg whites, and then add the flour and salt. Fold it lightly and quickly into the egg mixture. You got a really loose, puffy sort of cake batter here. Now, this is baked on a large, shallow 11 by 16 pan. It's called a jelly roll pan. 11 by 16, big and flat. Put a piece of parchment on the bottom. It didn't say butter the parchment, but you can't go wrong with butter, so I buttered the parchment just to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
You bake it in a 350-degree oven for 15 minutes. Be careful not to overbake it. Now, here's the tricky part. You take it out of the oven. You turn it onto a clean towel sprinkled generously with confectioner's sugar. And
so are you turning it upside down with the parchment on the top?
This is tricky. This is what the recipe said. I'm going to lose this on the kitchen floor if I turn this upside down. Don't do it that way. Take confectioner's sugar, sprinkle it over the slightly cooled pan of jelly roll cake,
mm-hmm.
and then put the towel on top of that,
mm-hmm.
put a cooling rack on top of that, and then turn the whole thing over onto the cooling rack. Lift off the baking pan.
Okay.
Peel off the parchment paper.
Mm-hmm.
There, you have avoided disaster. Let that cool for just a little bit so you can still touch it.
Are we talking like 3 minutes?
Up to 5 minutes.
Okay.
Now, while it is still sort of warm, here's the tricky bit. Take the towel that is now underneath the cake and roll it gently in on itself. Just roll towel and all and let it cool that way about half an hour.
Oh.
So the cake is already sort of in a roll. It's a moist cake. It will unroll again, but you have encouraged it to cool off into a curl. Then, after it's cooled off even more, take the cup of jam
spread
or jelly
the jam
on it,
around on it,
and then you can roll it up. And use the towel again to kind of roll on the outside and lift it up and kind of squeeze it together a little bit, roll it. And dust it again with confectioner's sugar if you want.
All right, so you take it out of the oven, you get it flipped over, and then you wait like 5 minutes or less
so you
to
can
put
handle,
it
yeah.
into the tea towel.
Into the tea towel. The tea towel is underneath
cotton
it.
Cotton one, not cotton. Not a fuzzy one,
not
right?
Not a fuzzy one, no.
No, like a cotton muslin mm-hmm, one probably. Mm-hmm. Roll it up. Then you let it cool how long? Half an hour?
I did because I didn't get back to it.
Mm-hmm.
But you want it to kind of set into that shape.
Right, but you don't want to leave it overnight. Like
No. So just feel it. Feel it mm-hmm. so it's not hot anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm, okay.
Then on whatever that
mm-hmm.
is. Not hot anymore. I did it a half hour. Then you unroll it, jelly it.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and also it suggests that you could trim off any kind of crispy burnt edges, because this is a pretty sort of thing. And eat the edges, because they're really good. Just trim off the edges.
That's where the children will come in
handy.
Yeah. Oh, it's delicious, Lana.
And then you roll it up. And actually, this thing tastes better after it's set a while.
Mm-hmm.
I tasted it right away.
Right, because the jelly will kind of soak into
It soaks in. Mm-hmm. I stored it in the refrigerator with a little cling wrap over the top. It was really better the next day, although the cake is delicious and whatever you put in it is delicious. It's good the next day. This is from a very old book I got from my grandmother's kitchen. It's called The Encyclopedia of Cooking, complete in 24 volumes, put out by the Culinary Arts Institute, copyright 1958.
I would bet that also there's a good one in The Joy of Cooking,
or they
can easily be found online. And probably the same technique would be good for, like, ice cream rolls, maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like with the chocolate cake and a vanilla ice cream is the classic.
Yes. Matter of fact, in this cookbook, it had pictures of lots of different things you could do. It's a relatively quick cake. It's a simple cake. You've already got a jar of jelly someplace or other. Go to the farmer's market. Get yourself a nice jar of jelly. And the only tricky part is this rolling up and unrolling part. Once you got that down, you're home free.
I would say that's probably a nice culinary technique to kind of have in your repertoire.
Oh, and you'll be so smug when you bring that out for a potluck.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. You're listening to KHOI Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio. We've been listening to some really golden oldie tunes from a CD called Early American Roots by the band Hesperus. It's a project from the Smithsonian Institute. And when I'm talking about golden oldies, this last tune was called Buttered Peas. It was written down, actually, in 1729. It's one of those English country dance tunes, all kinds of old stuff. So we're talking real golden oldies there.
Jelly rolls.
And we're eating jelly roll. What? That's a good combination. So to make jelly roll, you need to break a few eggs. So let's consider eggs and chickens for a minute. This is the fall, so the new chickens that I got in the spring are coming up. They're starting to lay. The old ones are kind of slowing down. They know it's fall. They know it's fall. So a big question. Wash or don't wash eggs?
I thought you were going to ask whether the chicken or the egg came first.
Oh, that's a whole show all by itself.
Inconclusive as well.
Right, right. Believe it or not, we are used to having eggs washed and refrigerated. Most of the rest of the world doesn't bother, either because it's really hard to refrigerate eggs for a long time in some countries, so most other countries don't mind letting unwashed eggs sit on the grocery shelf or on the kitchen shelf along next to your bread or onions. But here in this country, we bathe them a lot, and that means we have to refrigerate them a lot.
Because when you wash them, what do you wash off?
When you wash an egg comes with its own little coating. And if we wash that coating off straight from the chicken.
And the coating makes the shell impermeable, basically.
Right. The egg is a marvel in itself, and this coating, it prevents the egg from being porous, and it keeps out bad bacteria. It's like a little safety vest for the egg. The albumin, it goes around the egg. It keeps the bad bacteria out. And washing can damage that layer and increase the chances for bacterial invasion because the eggshell really is porous, teeny tiny holes, or there can be hairline cracks too. So, but in this country, we got, and a few other countries too, there is a possibility, of course, of getting salmonella from a badly done or badly stored egg.
Or badly raised chicken.
or a sick chicken. That will help, too. So bathing in soap and water has been the norm in this country for quite a long time. It leaves the cells squeaky clean, but it also compromises them by washing away this envelope that covers each egg. So if you do that, you have to refrigerate the eggs. Keep them cold. And that's a trick. If you're a producer, you have to get them in their refrigerator and keep them cold, take them to the people that you're cooking
with. So, Lana, to sell eggs at the farmer's market, do you have to wash them?
Yes. And they have to be in a cool container, a cooler with, mm-hmm. yeah. This is America. We want to wash and keep things clean.
So in your own personal kitchen?
In my own personal kitchen, I can leave eggs on the counter up for,
right. So the ones you're eating, you don't wash?
I don't. Unless a chicken has been really a little untidy. I mean, of course, there's going to be some eggs that are rather icky. Now, supposedly, it doesn't hurt to let the chicken poo stay on the egg, but I do take that. Well, and those I put in the refrigerator.
Well, and the other option is, of course, to wash it just before you use it.
Yes, that's what happens in the other countries where you sell eggs and just let them sit on the shelf. Eggs can last a long time. They can last on the counter or out in the air for a couple weeks. And in the refrigerator, some of those eggs that you buy in the refrigerator in grocery stores can be up to 2 months old.
I have heard they can be up to 6 months
old. They can be because refrigerating does slow things down. Mm-hmm. But even in the refrigerator, eggs are losing moisture. And that's why people have asked me about hard boiling a really fresh egg. It's hard because the really fresh egg is very, very full. The egg is very full of all of the yolk and the white on the inside, and it clings to the inside of the shell. It makes it hard to peel when you're hard boiling them. So make sure you're using slightly old, not too old, but slightly
old
eggs.
Even a week. 4 or 5 days.
At least. Which
is most eggs that one buys. Yeah. They're probably that old.
Yeah. So if you're talking about hard boiling eggs, that's why fresh eggs are really hard to peel. Also, a question for Donna. Pickled eggs.
Well, I love pickled eggs. Now, pickled eggs are traditionally a bar food, first in England and then also in this country. And I suspect that the wisdom was, if you have a shot of protein while you're busy getting drunk, that will kind of help your metabolism not be quite so hungover. So a pickled egg is a hard-boiled egg that has been peeled, and then it's submerged in mostly vinegar, or vinegar, and like pink pickled eggs seem to be popular, where you put a little beet or beet juice in it, or people seem to put onions in their jars. The recipes vary a lot. Some of the recipes include putting water or other liquids. Some are straight vinegars. Apple cider vinegar seems to be popular. And for my recipes, I have used straight apple cider vinegar, and I do keep them in the refrigerator. Although, obviously, when it was a bar food, the idea was the vinegar preserved the egg. Now you basically hard boil your eggs, you peel them, you put them in the vinegar, you leave them at least 4 or 5 days up to, you know, they can stay in the vinegar for a long time. Now, the larger the egg, the longer it will take for the flavor to penetrate. There's lots of flavoring options. Some people put beets and a pinch of clove, mustard seeds, coriander, bay leaves. You can curry. Some people make curried vinegar eggs.
Sounds
but
good.
I love keeping a stash of those in the fridge. It's a quick, high protein, low calorie treat. And do give it a try.
Pickled eggs. Another thing that we did this recently, Donna and I, we had all this interesting this and that we did this week. We took a trip to a concert on campus. We went to a marimba concert by the musician Matthew Coley. He's on the faculty.
And I felt like it was fresh air for my mind last night.
It was a really wonderful concert. He plays a lovely marimba. And we'll be listening to music to go out with here. He has an album. And he lives in Ames here, so celebrate that. His album is called Souvenirs. And this is a cut called Allegro Molto. And just a lovely sort of thing. Also, notice that there's going to be a lot of other things going on. Maximum Ames has lots of music this week. Come and dance at the Saturday Night Barn Dance. You can find out more about that at cibd.org, that's CentralIowaBarnDance.org. Also, the film, Symphony of the Soil, will be showing on campus next Monday, the 29th, at 1131 National Swine Research Information
Tuesday,
Center.
Isn't it?
Monday is
the film.
Film on Monday. It's part of the ISU Lecture Series and also part of the ISU Lecture Series. Tuesday, September 30th, the writer and director of the film Symphony of the Soil is Deborah Coons Garcia. She is wife of the late, great Jerry Garcia. I have heard it's a wonderful, wonderful film. And that will be...
It's quite beautiful.
Yes.
While being kind of instructive.
Right.
About soil science. You wouldn't think that's a fabulous topic, but boy, in her film, it really, really is.
Wonderful.
So you can see the film this week on Monday night, mm-hmm. and then you can hear Deborah Coons Garcia on Tuesday night, all at ISU. Where was that again, Lana?
It's part of the PESIC Lecture Series. I'm not quite sure. It's probably in the Union someplace. But anyway, so try new things this week. Enjoy the season. Bonfire responsibly if you're celebrating the equinox. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Listen to us Tuesdays at noon, repeated 7 o'clock in the evening. Eat good food and enjoy life.